listening to www.peoplesinternetradio.com, seeking solutions.
Up. 2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice. His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
Plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
The role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population from eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank's International Monetary Fund, IMF. And the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
With the ball with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
Okay, welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon in America, and Tuesday evening in Scotland, Ireland, elsewhere in the EU. I am Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel the Ball on Shake and Wake Radio, People's Internet Radio, and PSN Radio. I am going to continue reading The Invisible Rainbow, History of Electricity and Life by Arthur Furstenberg. Surprisingly, today, I feel pretty good. I mean, I was a little bit tired this morning, but that's normal. I normally don't get but about two and a half hours of sleep, and then I wake up and have to go to the bathroom, but for some reason, I got about 7 hours of sleep last night. I don't really know. I don't know what happened. So, hopefully, I'd like for that to happen every single day. But, that's not up to me. It's up to the it's up to whatever. But anyways. I need to put something on my screen so my screen don't go black on me. Got a nice long YouTube video with the sound muted. See what in the world I can find where I left off. I know I should get a little pen or something, or pencil, or mark where I leave off every time, but I have a pen sitting here right in front of me, but I haven't done that yet. Anyways, I'm just going to start at this page, this particular page, 100, where I left off, or somewhere close to it anyways, and continue reading. And I apologize if I have already read this, because I do not have a clue where I left off, but please bear with me. By 1904, two more had been added. I'm going to go back one single sentence, because that starting out that way just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So I'm going to go back to the previous page and start off there. In 1901, there were already two Marconi stations on the island of White, Marconi's original station, which had been moved to Nixon at the south end of the island next to St. Catherine's Lighthouse, and the Culver Signal Station, ran by the Coast Guard at the east end of the culver down. By 1904, two more had been added, according to the article published in that year by Eugene P. Lyle in the World's Work magazine. Four Marconi stations were now operating on the small island, communicating with the steadily growing number of naval and commercial ships. I know now by reading this that it was one of the last things I read, so I'm still going to go over it. Growing number of naval and commercial ships of many nations steaming through the channel that were equipped with similar apparatuses. It was the greatest concentration of radio signals in the world at that time. In 1906, the Lloyd's Signal Station, half a mile east of St. Catherine's Lighthouse, also acquired wireless equipment. At this point, the B station became so severe that the Board of Agriculture and Fisheries called in biologist Augustus Ames at Christ College, Cambridge, to investigate. 90% of the honeybees had disappeared from the entire island for no apparent reason. The hives all had plenty of honey, but the bees could not even fly. They are often to be seen crawling up grass stems or up the supports of the hives, where they remain until they fall back to the earth from sheer weakness, and soon afterwards die, he wrote. Swarms of healthy bees were imported from the mainland, but it was of no use. Within a week, the fresh bees were driven off by the thousands. Dying off by the thousands. In coming years, Isle of Wight disease spread like a plague throughout Great Britain and into the rest of the world. Severe losses of bees being reported in parts of Australia, Canada, United States, and South Africa. The disease also reported in Italy, Brazil, France, Switzerland, and Germany. Although for years, one or another parasitic mite was blamed. British bee pathologist Leslie Bailey disproved those theories in the 1950s and came to regard the disease itself as a sort of myth. Obviously, bees had died, he said, but not from anything contagious. Over time, Isle of Wight disease took fewer and fewer bee lives as the insects seemed to adapt to whatever had changed in their environment. Places that had been attacked first recovered first. Then in 1917, just as the bees on the Isle of Wight itself appeared to be regaining their former vitality, the event occurred that changed the electrical environment for the rest of the world. Millions of dollars of United States government money were suddenly mobilized into the crash program to equip the Army, Navy, and Air Force with the most modern communications capability possible. The entry of the United States into the Great War on April 6, 1917 stimulated an expansion of radio broadcasting that was as sudden and rapid as the 1889 expansion of electricity. Again, it was the bees that gave the first warning. Mr. Charles Schilke of Morgansville, Monmouth County, a beekeeper with considerable experience operating about 300 colonies, reported a great loss of bees from the hives in one of his yards located near Bradveld, read one report published in August 1918. Thousands of dead were lying and thousands of dying bees were crawling about in the vicinity of the hive, collecting in groups on beds appeared to be practically all young adult workers, about the age when they would normally do the first field work, but all ages of older bees were found. No abnormal condition without the hive was noticed at the time. The outbreak confined to Morganville, Freehold, Millhurst, and nearby areas of New Jersey, just a few miles seaward from one of the most powerful radio stations on the planet, the one in New Brunswick, New Jersey, that had just been taken over by the government for service in the war. The 50,000-watt Alexanderson alternator had been installed in February of that year to supply a less efficient 350,000-watt spark apparatus. Both provided power to a mile-long aerial consisting of 32 parallel wires supported by 12 steel towers 400 feet tall, broadcasting military communications across the ocean to the command in Europe. Radio came of age during the First World War. For long-distance communications, there were no satellites, no shortwave equipment. Vacuum tubes had not been perfected. Transistors were decades into the future. It was the era of immense radio waves. Inefficient aerials the size of small mountains and spark gap transmitters that scattered radiation like buckshot all over the radio spectrum to interfere with anyone else's signal. Oceans were crossed by brute force. 300,000 watts of electricity. Hang on a second here. Being supplied to those mountains to achieve a radiated power of perhaps 30,000. The rest was wasted as heat. Morse code could be sent, but not voice. Reception was sporadic and unreliable. Few of the great powers had had a chance to establish overseas communications with their colonies before war intervened in 1914. The United Kingdom had two ultra power stations at home, but no radio links with the colony. The first such links still under construction near Cairo. France had one powerful station at the Eiffel Tower and another in Lyon. But no links with any of its overseas colonies. Belgium had a powerful station in the Congo state, but blew up its home station at Brussels after war broke out. Italy had one powerful station in Eritrea, and Portugal had one Mozambique and one in Angola. Norway had one ultra-potent transmitter, Japan one, and Russia one. Only Germany had made much progress in building an imperial chain, but within months, during the declaration of war, all its overseas stations at Togo, Dar es Salaam, Samoa, Nuera, New Pomerania, Cameroon, Kiacho, and German East Africa were destroyed. Radio, in short, was in its faltering infancy, still crawling, its attempt to walk hindered by the onset of the European War. During 19 During 1915 and 1916, the United Kingdom made progress in installing 13 long-range stations in various parts of the world in order to keep its contact with its navy. When the United States entered the war in 1917, it changed the terrain in a hurry. The United States Navy had already one giant transmitter in Arlington, Virginia, and a second in Darien in the Canal Zone. A third in San Diego began broadcasting in May 1917, a fourth at Pearl Harbor on October 1 of that year, and a fifth at Cavite, the Philippines, on December 19th. The Navy also took over and upgraded private foreign-owned stations in Lentz, Oregon, South San Francisco, California, Bolinas, California, Kahuku, Hawaii, and Hurry Point, Hawaii, Sayville, and Long Island, Tuckerton, New Jersey, and New Brunswick, New Jersey. By late 1917, 13 American stations were sending messages across two oceans. 15 more medium and high-powered radio stations rang the United States and its possessions for communications with ships. To equip its ships, the Navy manufactured and deployed over 10,000 low, medium, and high-powered transmitters. By early 1918, the Navy was graduating over 400 students per week from its radio operating courses. In the short course of a year between August 6, 1917 and early 1918, the Navy built and was operating the world's largest radio network. America's transmitters were far more efficient than most of those built previously. When a 30 kilowatt Paulson arc was installed at Arlington in 1913, it was found to be much superior to the 100 kilowatt spark apparatus there that the Navy adapted the arc at its preferred equipment as its preferred equipment and ordered sets with higher and higher ratings. The 100 kilowatt arc was installed at Darien, a 200 kilowatt arc in San Diego, 350 kilowatt arcs at Pearl Harbor and Cavite. In 1917, 30 kilowatt arcs were being installed on Navy ships, outclassing the transmitters on most ships of other nations. I am going to take a short little 10-second break here and get a drink of water. Okay, give me a few seconds here. I bookmarked my page, but I still seem to... here we go. Still, the arc was basically only a spark gap and electricity flowing across it continuously instead of in bursts. It still sprayed the airway, and unwanted harmonics transmitted voices poorly and was not reliable enough for continuous day and night communications. So the Navy tried out its first high-speed alternator, the one it inherited at New Brunswick. Alternators did not have spark gaps at all. Like fine musical instruments, they produced pure continuous waves that could be sharply tuned and modulated from crystal clear voice or telegraphic communications. Ernst Alexanderson, who designed them, also designed an antenna to go with what that increased radiation efficiency sevenfold. When tested against the 350 kilowatt time spark at the same station, the 50 kilowatt alternator proved to have a bigger range. So in February 1918, the Navy began to rely on the alternator to handle continuous communications with Italy and France. In July 1918, another 200 kilowatt was added to the system the Navy had taken over at Sayville. In September 1918, the 500 kilowatt ARC went to the air at the new naval station in Annapolis, Maryland. Meanwhile, the Navy had ordered a second, more powerful alternator for New Brunswick of 200 kilowatt capacity, installed in June. It too went on the air full-time in September. New Brunswick immediately became the most powerful station in the world, outclassing Germany's flagship station at Neuen, and was the first transmitted both voice and telegraphic messages across the Atlantic clearly and continuously and reliably. Its signal was heard over the large part of the earth. The disease was called Spanish influenza and was born during these months. It did not originate in Spain. It did, however, kill tens of millions all over the world, and it became suddenly more fatal in September 1918. By some estimates, the pandemic struck more than 500 million people, or a third of the world's population. Even the Black Death of the 14th century did not kill so many in so short a period of time. No wonder everybody is terrified of its return. A few years ago, researchers dug up 4 bodies in Alaska that had lain frozen in a permafrost since 1918 and were able to identify RNA from the influenza virus in the lung tissue of one of them. This was the monster germ that was supposed to have felled so many in the prime of their lives, the microbe that so resembles a virus of pigs, against whose return are to be excised eternal vigilance, lest it decimate the world again. I've actually heard that report that, hang on a second, I need to send somebody a message, so hang on, please. Yes, I had actually heard that they did dig the 4 bodies up there in Alaska, and they were trying to get the virus, apparently to study it, in their own words, or whatever you want to call it, but probably more likely to remanufacture it and do nefarious things with it, whatever the case is. That's just my opinion, and I'm probably digressing, but well, okay, let's see if I can find my place again. But there is still no evidence that the disease in 1918 was contagious. The Spanish influenza apparently originated in the United States in early 1918, seemed to spread around the world on Navy ships, and first appeared on board those ships and in seaports and naval stations. The largest early outbreak, lying low, about 400 people, occurred in February in the Naval Radio School at Cambridge, Massachusetts. In March, influenza spread to army camps where the Signal Corps was being trained in the use of wireless. 1,127 men contracted influenza in Camp Funston in Kansas. 2,900 men in the Oglethorpe camps in Georgia. In late March and April, the disease spread to the civilian population and around the world. Mild at first, the epidemic exploded with death in September everywhere in the world at once. Waves of mortality traveled with astonishing speed over the global ocean of humanity again and again until their force was finally spent 3 years later. Okay, everyone, I'm going to take a little one song break here. Maybe two short songs and come back for some more. It's actually going to be some live, well, not live, but YouTube. A couple of YouTube songs. So be back in a few minutes, everyone.
In the resurrection morning, when the trump of God shall sound, we shall rise, we shall rise. Then the saints will come rejoicing, and no tears will ever be found. We shall rise, we shall rise, we shall rise, we shall rise. Amen, we shall rise. In the resurrection morning, when this prison bars are broken, we shall rise.
Okay, just one quick song there, and I'll come back because this is a I don't know what you want to call it, a playlist. It's got 69 songs in it, so unless you stop it at the end, it's going to go right to the next song and just continue to go. So I will probably end up playing the next song on the next break here. Its victims were often sick repeatedly for months at a time. One of the few things that puzzled doctors the most was all of the bleeding. 10 to 15% of the flu patients seen in private practice and up to 40% of flu patients in the Navy suffered from nosebleeds. Doctors sometimes described the blood as gushing from the nostrils. Others bled from their gums, ears, skin, stomach, intestines, uterus, or kidneys. The most common and rapid route to death being hemorrhage in the lungs. Flu victims drowned in their own blood. Autopsies revealed that as many as one-third of fatal cases had also hemorrhaged into their brain. And occasionally a patient appeared to be recovering from respiratory symptoms only to die of a brain hemorrhage. The regularity with which these various hemorrhages appeared suggested the possibility of there being a kind of blood, of there being a change in the blood itself, wrote Dr. Arthur Erskine and B.L. Knight of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in late 1918. So they tested the blood from the large number of patients with influenza and pneumonia. In every case tested without a single exception, they wrote, the coagulability of the blood was lessened. The increase in time required for coagulation varying from 2.5 to 8 minutes more than normal. Blood was tested as early as the second day of infection and as late as the 20th day of convalescence from pneumonia, with the same results. Several local physicians also tested blood from their patients, and while our records are at this time necessarily incomplete, we have yet to receive a report of a case in which the time of coagulation was not prolonged. This is consistent not with any respiratory virus, but with what has been known about electricity ever since Gerhard did the first experiment on human blood in 1779. It is consistent with what is known about the effects of radio waves on blood coagulation. Erskine and Knight saved their patients not by fighting infection, but by giving them large doses of calcium lactate to facilitate blood clotting. Another astonishing fact that makes no sense in this pandemic was infectious, but that makes good sense of it was caused by radio waves, is that instead of striking down the old and the infirm like most diseases, this one killed mostly healthy, vigorous young people between the ages of 18 and 40. Just as the previous pandemic had done, with a little less vehemence, in 1889, with a little less vehemence in 1889. This, as we saw in Chapter 5, is the same as a predominant age range from neurasthenia, the chronic form of electric illness. 2/3 of the influenza deaths were in this age range. Elderly patients were rare. One doctor in Switzerland wrote that he knew of one case. He knew of no case in an infant and no severe cases in persons over 50, but that one robust person showed the first symptoms at 4 p.m. and died before 10 the next morning. A reporter in Paris went as far as to say the only person between 15 and 40 of age, only 15 and 40 years of age are affected. The prognosis was better if you were in poor physical condition. That's weird. If you were undernourished, physically handicapped, anemic, or tuberculosis, you were much less likely to get the flu and much less likely to die from it if you did. Guess that's why I haven't gotten the flu in 25 years, because of all the medical problems I have. I don't know. This was such a common observation that Dr. D.B. Armstrong wrote a provocative article published in the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal titled Influenza. It is a hazard to be healthy. Doctors were seriously discussing whether they were actually giving their patients a death sentence by advising them to keep fit. The flu was reported to be even more fatal for pregnant women. A further peculiarity that had doctors scratching their heads was, in most cases, after the patient's temperature had returned to normal, their pulse rate began to fall. Their pulse rate fell below 60 and remained there for a number of days. In more serious cases, the pulse rate fell to between 36 and 48, an indication of heart block. This, too, is puzzling for a respiratory virus, but will make sense when we learn about radio wave sickness. Patients also regularly lost most of their hair 2 to 3 months after recovering from the flu. According to Samuel Ayers, a dermatologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, this was almost a daily occurrence, most of these patients being young women. This is not an expected after effect of respiratory viruses either, but hair loss has been widely reported from exposure to radio waves. Yet another puzzling observation was that so few patients in 1918 had sore throats, runny noses, or other initial respiratory symptoms, but neurological symptoms, just as the pandemic in 1889, were rampant, even in mild cases. They ranged from insomnia, stupor, dulled perceptions, unusually heightened perceptions, tingling, itching, and impairment of hearing to weakness or partial paralysis of the palate, the eyelids, and various other muscles. A famous Carl Menninger reporter on 100 cases, the famous Carl Menninger reported on 100 cases of psychosis triggered by influenza, including 35 of schizophrenia, that he saw during a 3-month period. Although the infectious nature of this illness was widely assumed, masks, quarantines, and isolation were all without effect. Interesting. Even in an isolated country like Iceland, the flu spread universally in spite of quarantining of its victims. The disease seemed to spread immediately fast. There is no reason to support that it traveled more rapidly than persons could travel, but it was apparent to do so, wrote Dr. George A. Soper, major in the U.S. Army. But most revealing of all were the various heretic attempts to prove the infectious nature of this disease, testing volunteers. All these attempts, made in November and December of 1918 and February and March 1919, failed. One medical team in Boston, working for the United States Public Health Service, tried to infect 100 healthy volunteers between the ages of 18 and 25. Their efforts were impressive and make entertaining reading. We collected all the material and mucus secretions of the mouth and nose and throat and bronchi from cases of disease and transferred this to our volunteers. We always obtained this material in the same way. The patient with fever in bed had a large, shallow, tray-like arrangement before him or her, and we washed out one nostril with some sterile salt solutions, using perhaps 5 cc's, which is allowed to run into a tray, and that nostril is blown vigorously into the tray. This is repeated with the other nostril. The patient then gargles with some of the solution. Oh, that's going to put a good visual in everybody's brain. Thank you so much there, Mr. Furstenberg. That's a nice visual. Next, we obtained some bronchial mucus through coughing, and then we swabbed the mucus surface of each nares and also the mucus surface of the throat. Each one of the volunteers received 6 cc's of the mixed stuff that I have described. They received it into each nostril, received it into the throat and on the eye. And when you think that 6 cc's in all we used, we understand that some of it was swallowed. None of them took sick. And thanks again for the visuals. In a further experiment with new volunteers and donors, the salt solution was eliminated, and with cotton swabs, the material was transferred directly from nose to nose and from throat to throat using donors in the first, second, or third day of the disease. None of these volunteers who received the material thus directly transferred from cases took sick in any way. All of the volunteers received at least 2 and some of them 3 shots, as they expressed it. In the further experiment, 20 cc's of blood from each of 5-6 donors were mixed and injected into each volunteer. None of them took sick in any way. Then we collected a lot of mucus material from the upper respiratory tract and filtered it through Mandler filters. This filtrate was injected into 10 volunteers, one receiving 3.5 cc's subcutaneously, and none of these took sick in any way. Yeah, I know, Annie. unsee. Where's the unsee button? Then in a further attempt was made to transfer a disease in the natural way, using flesh volunteers and donors. The volunteer was led up to the bedside of the patient. He was introduced. He sat down alongside the bed of the patients. They shook hands, and by instructions, he got as close as he conveniently could, and they talked for minutes. At the end of the 5 minutes, the patient breathed out as hard as he could, while a volunteer muzzle to muzzle, in accordance with the instructions, about 2 inches between the two, received this expired breath, and at the same time was breathing in as the patient breathed out. Pretty much like a breathing kiss, I guess, what it seems like to me. The sick patient breathed out, and the healthy volunteer breathed in. After they had done this for 5 minutes, the patient's coughed directly into the face of the volunteer, face to face, 5 different times. Then he moved to the next patient whom he had selected and repeated this, and so on, until this volunteer had had that sort of contact with 10 different cases of influenza in different stages of the disease, mostly fresh cases, none of them more than 3 days old. None of them took sick in any way. We entered the outbreak with the notion that we knew the cause of the disease and were quite sure until we knew how it was transmitted from person to person, perhaps, concluded Dr. Milton Rosenow. If we have learned anything, it is that we are not quite sure what we know about the disease. Earlier attempts to demonstrate contagion in horses had met with the same resounding failure. Healthy horses were kept in close contact with sick ones during all stages of the disease. Nose bags were kept on horses that had nasal discharge and high temperatures. These nose bags were used to contain food for other horses which, however, stubbornly remained healthy. As a result of these and other attempts, Lieutenant Colonel Herbert Watkins Pitchford of the British Army Veterinary Corps wrote in July 1917 that he could find no evidence that influenza was ever spread directly from one horse to another. The other two influenza pandemics of the 20th century in 1957 and 1968 were also associated with milestones in electrical technology, pioneered once again by the United States. Radar first used extensively during World War II was deployed on a spectacular scale by the United States during the mid-1950s as it sought to surround itself with a triple layer of protection that would detect any nuclear attack. The first and smallest barrier was the 39 stations in the Pine Tree Line, which kept vigil from coast to coast across South Canada and Nova Scotia, northward to Baffin Island. This line, completed in 1954, was the roots, as it were, for the huge tree of surveillance that grew between 1956 and 1958, whose branches spread across mid and high latitude Canada, sent schools, sent chutes into Alaska, and dropped down over the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans to guard the United States on east, west, and north. It was complete When it was completed, hundreds of the radar domes, resembling golf balls the size of buildings, littered the Canadian landscape from ocean to ocean and from the American border to the Arctic. I think I've seen pictures of them giant domes he was talking about. Or maybe some sort of a documentary or something. I don't know what it was now. The Mid-Canadian Line, extending 2,700 miles from Hopedale, Labrador, to Dawson Creek, British Columbia, consisted of 98 powerful Doppler radars 30 miles apart and roughly 300 miles north of Pine Tree Line. Construction on the first station began on October 1, 1956, and the completed system was dedicated on January 1, 1958. The 58 stations of the Distant Early Warning, or DEW, line kept that frozen watch roughly along the 69th parallel, 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle, in a chain extended from Baffin Island to the Northwest Territories and across Alaska. Each main site, of which there were 33, had two pulsed transmitters, one controlling a pencil beam for a long-range precision tracking, and the other wider beam for a general surveillance. Each beam had a peak power of 500 kilowatts, as that each site had a maximum peak capacity of 1 million watts. The frequency was between 1,220 and 1,350 megahertz. The other 25 gap filler stations had continuous wave Dopplers rated at 1 kilowatt and operated at 500 megahertz. Construction began in 1955 of the completed system was dedicated in July 31st, 1957. The DEW line, Distant Early Warning, DEW line, extended down into the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans in lines of Navy ships, four in the Atlantic and five in the Pacific, supplemented by fleets of Lockheed aircraft, and cruised in 12 to 14 hour shifts at 3,000 to 6,000 feet in altitude. The radar bearing ships and planes of the Atlantic Barrier were based in Maryland and Newfoundland and patrolled the waters out to the Azores. Atlantic operations began testing on July 1, 1956 and were fully deployed 1 year later. The Pacific Barrier, based in Hawaii and Midway, scanned the ocean off western North America and paralleled roughly from Midway to Kodiak Island. Its first two ships were assigned to Pearl Harbor in 1956, and the barrier became fully operational July 1, 1958. In addition, three Texas towers equipped with long-range radars were placed about 100 miles off the Atlantic coast and affirmed to be affixed to the ocean floor. The first 110 miles east of Cape Cod began operation in December 1955, with the third 84 miles southwest of New York Harbor was activated in early summer 1957. Finally, every one of the 195 initial radar sites blanketed Canadian skies had to be able to send surveillance data from mostly very remote locations, and so high power radio transmitters were added to each site, typically operating in the microwave spectrum between 600 and 1,000 megahertz. With broadcast powers of up to 40 kilowatts. They used a technology called tropospheric scatter. Huge antennas the shape of covered billboards aimed their signals above the distant horizon so as to bounce them off particles in the lower atmosphere 6 miles away, 6 miles above the Earth, and thereby reach the receiver hundreds of miles away. Another complete network of such antennas, called the White Alice Communication System, was installed all throughout Alaska at the same time. The first ones were put into service on November 12, 1956, and the complete system was dedicated on March 26, 1958. The Asian influenza pandemic began about the end of February 1957 and lasted for more than a year. The bulk of the mortality occurred in the fall and winter of 1957 and 1958. A decade later, the United States launched the world's first constellation of military satellites into orbit at an altitude of 18,000 nautical miles, right in the heart of the outer Van Allen radiation belt. Called the Initial Defense Communication Satellite Program, IDCSP. Its 28 satellites became operational after the last eight were launched in June 13, 1968. The Hong Kong flu pandemic began in July 68 and lasted until March of 1970. Although there had already been a few satellites in space, they had all been launched one at a time during the 1960s, and at the beginning of 1968, there had been a total of 13 operating satellites orbiting above the Earth. In one fell swoop, the IDCSP not only more than tripled the number, but placed them in the middle of the most valuable layer of the Earth's magnetosphere. In each case, 1889, 1918, 1957, in 1968, the electrical envelope of the Earth, which will be described in the next chapter, and that didn't make any sense. I'm going to start that over. In each case, in 1889, 1918, 1957, and 1968, the electrical envelope of the Earth, which will be described in the next chapter, and two, which we all attached by invisible strings, was suddenly and profoundly disturbed. Those for whom this attachment was strong, whose roots were most vital, whose life's rhythms were turned, most closely to the accustomed pulsations of our planet. In other words, vigorous, healthy young adults and pregnant women, those who were the individuals who were most affected and died. Like an orchestra whose conductor was suddenly gone mad, their organs, their living instruments, no longer knew how to play. Okay, I ran over there a little bit to finish out that chapter 8. We're going to go to chapter 9 after a break here. Be right back in a few minutes again, everyone.
In heaven, this little girl came up to me. She told me she died in your tummy.
Years I spent in vanity and
At Coulter Family Dentistry, we'll help you get the unique smile you deserve. If you hate having impressions.
Yes, it does feel like you're at a Baptist church service or something like that. I've been listening to Bill Gaither for a long time. Well, ever since I've been on the internet, 2009. That's when I first started listening to him on YouTube. Going into chapter 9, Earth Electric Envelope. All things by immortal power, near or far, hiddenly to each other linked are, that thou canst not stir a flower without troubling of a star. Francis Thompson in the Mistress of Vision. Yeah, you're welcome. I love it too. When I look at a flower, what I see is not the same as what a honeybee sees, who comes to drink its nectar. She sees beautiful patterns of ultraviolet and that are invisible to me. And she is blind to the red to the color red. A red poppy is ultraviolet to her. I don't even know what that is. Cinquefoil? A cinquefoil flower, which looks pure yellow to me, is to her purple, with a yellow center luring her to its nectar. Most white flowers are blue-green to her eye. When I look upon the night's sky, the stars appear as points of color twinkling through Earth's atmosphere. Everywhere else, except for the moon and a few planets, is blackness, but it is the blackness of illusion. If you could see all the colors in the world, including the ultraviolets that honeybees can see, the infrareds that snakes can see, the low electric frequencies that catfish and salamanders can see, the radio waves, the X-rays, the gamma rays, the slow galactic pulsations, if you could see everything that is really there in its myriad shapes and hues, in all its blinding glory instead of blackness, you'd see forms and motion everywhere, day and night. Almost all of the matter in the universe is electrically charged, an endless sea of ionized particles called plasma, named after the contents of living cells because of its unpredictable life-like behavior of electrified matter. The stars we see are made of electrons, protons, and have atomic nuclei and other charged particles and consistent motion. The space between the stars and galaxies, far from being empty, teems with electrically charged subatomic particles, swimming in vast, swirling electromagnetic fields, accelerated by those fields to near light speeds. Plasma is such a good conductor of electricity, far better than any metals that filaments of plasma. Invisible wires, billions of light years long, transport electromagnetic energy in gigantic circuits from one part of the universe to another, shaping the heavens. Under the influence of electromagnetic forces, over billions of years, cosmetic whirlpools of matter collect along these filaments, like beads on a string, evolving into the galaxies that decorate our night sky. In addition, thin sheaths of electric current, called double layers, like the membranes of biological cells, divide intergalactic space into immense compartments, each of which can have different physical, chemical, electrical, and magnetic properties. There may even, some speculate, be matter on the other side of a double layer and antimatter on the other. Enormous electric fields prevent the different regions of space from mixing. Just as the integrity of our own cells is preserved by the electric fields of the membranes surrounding them. Our own Milky Way, in which we live, a medium-sized spiral galaxy 100,000 light-years across, rotates around its center once every 250 million years, generating around itself a galaxy-sized magnetic field. Filaments of plasma 500 light-years away long, generating additional magnetic fields, have been photographed looking out of our galactic centers, looping out our galactic center. Our sun, also made of plasma, sends out an ocean of electrons, protons, and helium ions in a steady current called the solar wind, blowing a 300 miles per hour a second. It bathes the Earth as all of the planets before diffusing out into the plasma between the stars. The Earth, with its core of iron, rotates on its axis in the electric fields of the solar system and the galaxy. And as it rotates, it generates its own magnetic field that traps and deflects the charging particles of the solar wind. They wrap the Earth in an envelope of plasma called the magnetosphere, which stretches out on the night side of the planet onto a comet-like tail hundreds of millions of miles long. Some of the particles of the solar wind collect in layers we call the Van Allen belts, where they circulate 600 to 35,000 miles above our heads, driven along magnetic lines of force towards the poles. The electrons collide with oxygen and nitrogen atoms in the upper atmosphere. These fluoresce to produce the northern and southern lights, the aurora borealis and the australis, that dance in the winter nights of the high latitudes. The sun also bombards our planet with ultraviolet light and X-rays. These strike the air 50 to 250 miles above us, ionizing it, freeing the electrons that carry electric currents into the upper atmosphere. This, the Earth's own layer of plasma, is called the ionosphere. The sun also The Earth is also showered with charged particles from all directions called cosmic rays. These are atomic nuclei and subatomic particles that traveled at velocities approaching the speed of light. From within the Earth comes radiation emitted by uranium and other radioactive elements, Cosmic rays from space and radiation from the rocks and soil provide the small ions that carry the electric currents that surround us in the lower atmosphere. In this electromagnetic environment, we evolve. We all live in a fairly constant vertical electric field averaging 130 volts per meter. In fair weather, the ground beneath us has a negative charge. The ionosphere above us has a positive charge. And the potential difference between ground and sky is about 300,000 volts. The most spectacular reminder that electricity is always playing around us, around and through us, bringing messages from the sun and stars, is, of course, lightning. Electricity courses through the sky far above us, explodes downward in thunderstorms, rushes through the ground beneath us, and flows gently back up through the air in fair weather, carried by small ions. All of this happens continuously as electricity animates the entire Earth. About 100 bolts of electricity, each delivering a trillion watts of energy, strike the Earth every second. During thunderstorms, the electric tension in the air around us can reach 4,000 volts per meter and more. When I first learned about the global electrical circuit 25 years ago, I drew the following sketch. Nothing you can't see, so disregard that. Living organisms, as the drawing indicates, are part of the global circuit. Each of us generates our own electric fields, which keep us vertically polarized like the atmosphere. With our feet and hands negative with respect to our spine and head. Our negative feet walk on the negative ground as our positive heads point to the positive sky. The complex electric circuits that course gently through our bodies are completed by the ground and sky. And this is very special way, and in this very special way, the Earth and the Sun, the great yin and the great yang of the Yellow Emperor's classic are energy sources for life. I'm gonna do about another 10 minutes here, folks. My back's bothering me pretty bad today. I don't know. I got plenty of sleep last night, but my back is still bothering me today, and it's interfering with my concentration. So I'm going to go till 5:30, and that would be 10:30 over there in Scotland. Then I'll call it for the day. I will pause for just a few seconds and get a drink of water here, so... It is not widely appreciated that the reverse is also true. Not only does life need the earth, but the earth needs life. The atmosphere, for example, exists only because green things have been growing for billions of years. Plants created the oxygen, all of it, and very likely the nitrogen too. But we failed to treat our fragile cushion of air as the irreplaceable treasure that it is. Yet we fail to treat our fragile cushion of air as the irreplaceable treasure that it is, more precious than the rarest diamond, because for every atom of coal or oil that we burn, for every molecule of carbon dioxide that we produce from them, we destroy forever our molecule of oxygen. The burning of fossil fuels. Okay, a little bit of an agenda here. The burning of fossil fuels of ancient plants that once breathed life into the future is really the undoing of creation. Electrically, too, life is essential. Living trees rise hundreds of feet into the air from the negatively charged ground, and because most raindrops, except in thunderstorms, carry positive charge down to earth, and trees attract rain out of the clouds, and the felling of trees contributes electrically towards a loss of rainfall where forests used to stand. As for men, said Lauren easily, those myriad little detached pounds that our own swarming corpuscular life, that what were they but a way that water has of going about beyond the reach of rivers. Not only we, but especially trees, are the earth's way of watering the desert. Trees increase evaporation and lower temperatures, and the currents of life speeding through their sap are continuous above the sky and the rain. Well, like I said, there's a bit of an agenda going on here. This guy's looked into the electricity, but he hasn't looked into global warming. Sounds like he's buying that argument, hook, line, and sinker. We are all part of a living Earth. As the Earth is the member of a living solar system and a living universe, the play in electricity across the galaxy, the magnetic rhythm of the planets, the 11-year cycle of sunspots, the fluctuations of a solar wind, thunder and lightning upon the earth, this earth, biological currents within our bodies, that the one depends upon all the others. We are like tiny cells in a body of the universe. Events on the other side of the galaxy affect all life here on earth, and it is perhaps not too far-fetched to say that any dramatic change in life on earth would have a small but noticeable effect on the sun and stars. When the City and South London Electrical Railway began operating in 1890, it interfered with delicate instruments at the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, 4.5 miles away. Little did the physicist there know about electromagnetic waves, from what that and every other electric railway were also radiating into space and altering the Earth's magnetosphere, a fact that would not be discovered until decades later. To understand its significance for life, let us return to the story of lightning. The house we live in, which is the biosphere, a roughly 55-mile high space filled with air that wraps around the earth, is a resonant cavity that rings like a gong every time a lightning bolt strikes. In addition to maintaining the static electric field of 130 volts per meter in which we all stand and walk, and in which birds fly, lightning sets the biosphere ringing in a particular low frequency tones, 8 beats per second or hertz, 14, 20, 26, 32, and so forth. These tones are named for Winfried Schumann, a German physicist who predicted their existence and who, with his student Herbert Koenig, proved their constant presence in the atmosphere in 1953. It so happens that in a state of awake relaxation, our brains tune in to this precise frequencies. The dominant pattern of a human electrocephalogram from before birth through adulthood, the well-known alpha rhythm ranging from 8 to 13 hertz or 7 to 13 hertz in a newborn is bounced by the first two Schumann resonance. Also an old part of the brain called the limbic system, which is involved in emotions and a long-term memory, produces theta waves of 4 to 8 hertz, which are bounded above by the first Schumann resonance. The theta rhythm is more prominent in young children and in adults in mediation. These same frequencies, alpha and theta, are surprisingly little variation pulsate as far as is known in all animals. In the state of relation, dogs show an alpha rhythm identical to ours of 8 to 12 hertz. In cats, the range is slightly higher from 8 to 15 hertz. Rabbits, guinea pigs, goats, cows, frogs, birds, and reptiles all show nearly the same frequencies. Schumann's student, Koenig, was so impressed by the resemblance these atmospheric waves bear to the electrical oscillations of the brain that he conducted a series of experiments with far-reaching implications. The first Schumann resonance, he wrote, is so completely identical to the alpha rhythm that even an expert is hard-pressed to say the difference between tracings from the brain and the atmosphere. Koenig did not think this was a coincidence. The first Schumann resonance appeared during fair weather, he noted, in calm, balanced conditions, just as the alpha rhythms appeared in the brain in the calm, relaxing state. The delta rhythm, on the other hand, which consists of irregular higher amplitude waves around 3 hertz, appears in the atmosphere under disturbed, unbalanced weather conditions and in the brain in disturbed or diseased states, headaches, spastic conditions, tumors, and so forth. Okay, everyone, I'm going to mark my place so I know where I'm at next time. My back is giving me fits, so I'm going to call it for the day. And I do appreciate everyone coming out and listening to the book. So I'll probably see everyone on Sunday for a Brittenberry show. And until next time, thanks. Each day.
At Coulter Family Dentistry, we'll help you get the unique smile you deserve. If you hate having impressions taken, here...
www.peoplesinternetradio.com. Seeking solutions.